Chapter 8. It's All About Him. Isaiah 6, 1 through 8. Isaiah 6 has made its mark in my life and has kept me running throughout my life, especially over the past several years. I have gradually come to the realization that life is not about me. I am not a quick study on some of these things. This chapter places us in the year when Isaiah saw the Lord. Brennan Manning is the author of a book called Ruthless Trust. In it, he shares from the movie Waking Ned Divine. A 10-year-old boy asked the interim pastor of his church, "Do you ever see God?" "Not directly," says the young pastor, "though I get revelations." "Does your job pay well?" inquires the boy. No, the rewards of my work are mostly spiritual." Then the pastor asks the boy, "Have you ever thought about a life of service to the church?" "Not really," he says. "I don't want to work for someone I never see and who doesn't even pay minimum wages." How about you? Isn't that something that we all struggle with? Life would be so much different if we could just see him and hear from him directly. His written word is great, but we would love to hear his voice. This is what the prophet Isaiah experienced. It came at the most difficult time in his life. For it was in the year that King Uzziah died that I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, Isaiah 6, 1-3. What Isaiah was about to see and hear touched him so deeply that he was never the same after that encounter. He was already a believer. He was a prophet. He knew God. Isaiah made ready for a divine encounter. Some background on Isaiah is helpful here. He was born of nobility, born Isaiah ben Amoz. He was a recognized statesman, having access to the royal court of his day. He counseled and rubbed shoulders with princes and kings. He was well-educated. He was not some kind of a loony belonging on a funny farm, speaking about some hallucination that he had. We hear people today talking about revival, barking like dogs, hopping like frogs, laughing like hyenas, roaring like lions, and hooting like owls. But there was none of this with Isaiah. This was the real thing, a genuine revival through a close encounter with the God of the universe. I contend that all genuine revival follows this pattern. We see the Lord in his holiness, and then we see ourselves in our sinfulness, and finally, we see others in their neediness. King Uzziah was one of the better kings who ruled over Judah. He became king when he was only 16 years of age and reigned for the next 52 years. He brought great stability to the land of Judah. Contrast this with our own country. In the past 52 years, we have had 10 presidents, from General Eisenhower to President George Walker Bush. A good number of the people of Judah were born and died under the reign of King Uzziah. He was all they knew. Unfortunately, he did not finish well. In the eyes of the people, he had done no wrong, but in God's eyes, he had committed a grievous sin involving his pride. After he acquired great wealth and power, like many in places of power, he began to think that he was above the law. But in his case, he violated the laws of God. He boldly entered the temple and arrogantly assumed priestly powers. When the priest tried to stop him, he became enraged. In the midst of his rage, leprosy broke out on his forehead. He ended his days living in a separate house, being a leper, cut off from the house of the Lord. 2 Chronicles 26:21. In spite of this, when he died, it was a time of deep mourning. It was a time of great national uncertainty. It was the end of an era. What did the future hold? Isaiah probably went to the temple to get some answers. He wanted to hear something from God about the future. He received much more than he had hoped for. Have you noticed how it is often in times of sorrow and tragedy that God meets with us in fresh, new, and revitalizing ways? The year 1963 was a memorable one for me. God had called me into the ministry in 1957, but I must admit that I had thoughts about rejoining my dad and two brothers back on the farm. Connie and I had attended a Bible college in the South for the first year and a half after high school. When we returned home for the holidays at the end of 1962, we discovered that my mom had an advanced case of breast cancer. She had kept the information from us during the fall semester, but could not keep it hidden any longer. So we decided to go back to college and finish the semester in early January and then come back home to care for my mom and my younger brother and sister and try to help my dad where we could. Mom died on April 7th, 1963, and it shook my world. I guess even at that point in my life, I had never looked at the mortality of my own parents, let alone my own life. I was living in a state of illusion. Others were dying, but I never thought much about the death of those close to me. This forced me to think deeply about death and life after death. On top of that, a close friend of my parents who did some carpentry work for my father stopped in almost daily to check with my dad, but also to share the latest radio message from some of the Bible teachers on radio at the time. Suddenly, our friend died of a heart attack. That, too, was another reminder to me of the brevity of this life. Then the really big one came on November 22nd of that year, when news spread quickly around the nation concerning the great tragedy that took place in Dallas, Texas. Our youthful president had been assassinated in the prime of his life. Though I was not a great fan of the president at the time, I could not help but feel deep sorrow for the Kennedy family and for the rest of the nation. We watched the events in Dallas unfold, along with the swearing-in of President Johnson aboard Air Force One as he returned to Washington. It was a time of great uncertainty. Was this a conspiracy? Was there more to come? I don't know about you, but for me, it was one more reminder that year that life is very temporary at best. My parents had a framed poem hanging over the stove in the kitchen. It went like this: only one life, 'twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. This was a wake-up call, and for me, it was time to experience the Lord's presence and call all over again. Later, another poem I heard stated the same truth. The clock of life is wound but once, and no man has the power to say just when the clock will stop, at late or early hour. Now is the only time you own to do His precious will. Do not wait until tomorrow, for the hands may then be still. Yep, it was time for me to get back in the race. I transferred to Detroit Bible College, later becoming William Tyndale College, for the next semester beginning in January of 1964, and I have never looked back. So I can similarly say, as Isaiah, that it was in the year that my mother died and the president was assassinated that I had my encounter with and a renewed call from God. This longtime king Uzziah, the well-respected king of Judah, was dead. But when Isaiah entered the temple, he encountered the real king. The real king was very much alive and on his throne and about to make his presence real to Isaiah. There are three things that Isaiah saw in that temple. Isaiah saw the Lord. First, he saw the Lord. The word for Lord is Adonai. The word means master or sovereign one. This was a title that was reserved for God alone. It was also the title that was given to Jesus in the New Testament. We have titles and names today. Over the years, some would call me Pastor, and others would call me Steve. And some have even called me less flattering names. And when my wife gets irritated with me, she refuses to use the term of endearment that we have used with each other over the years. Dear! It becomes Stephen! A very formal name, and on rare occasions, I have heard Stephen Phillip with my middle name. I played a practical joke on a friend, Larry Heppes, one day, and he called me Maggot. That was the only time that I can recall where I was blessed with that designation. One of Job's counselors, Bildad, in Job 25:6, referred to man as a maggot and a worm. Steve is my name, pastor is my title. God has many different names. Jesus has many different names and titles. But Lord speaks of who he is in title. He is the sovereign Lord of the universe. He is the one who is controlling all things. He is reigning. He is the real king. Kings and presidents and prime ministers and their administrations will come and go. But the real king lives forever. And of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Isaiah 9:7. The interesting truth behind this passage that is often overlooked is that the one whom Isaiah saw in this passage was none other than a pre-incarnate appearance of the Lord Jesus Christ. In John 12:38-40, John is quoting from this sixth chapter of Isaiah. Then, in John 12:41, we read, "These things Isaiah said when he saw his glory and spoke of him." There it is clear that he is speaking of Jesus. The title Lord speaks more of his transcendence. The name Yahweh, which meant the covenant-keeping God of Israel, speaks of his eminence. God is both transcendent and high and lifted up above us, and at the same time he is immanent, very much interested in what is going on in our personal lives. Years ago, a popular song said it so well. The title of the song was, "How Big Is God?" The words were, "How big is God? How big and wide his vast domain? To try to tell, these lips can only start. He's big enough to rule his mighty universe, yet small enough to live within the heart." Isaiah saw him high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filling the temple. All of this speaks of his awesome transcendent power, his majesty and royalty. King Uzziah, in his finest hour, could not hold a candle to the real king who is seated upon the throne. Several years ago, we had a private tour of Air Force One while Bill Clinton was president. One of the young men from our congregation, Everett DeWolf III, son of the elder Everett and Ruth DeWolf, served as the navigator on Air Force One for two presidents during his 13-year tour of duty. I remember walking all through the plane and even sitting down behind the desk in the flying Oval Office where the phone, hanging next to the desk, gave the president immediate contact with many of the great world leaders. It was a brief, fleeting feeling of power. But nothing can compare with the kind of power that Isaiah felt, being in the presence of the all-powerful one. This was the real control room in the universe. Isaiah was used to being in the presence of kings and other dignitaries, but he had never seen anything like this. He was associated with princes and kings. He knew what it was to be surrounded by greatness and in the presence of greatness. Back in 1994, we were invited to the inauguration of George W. Bush as governor of Texas. We attended a prayer breakfast where there were perhaps 250 to 300 invited guests, mainly pastors and spouses. Governor Bush stood to address those gathered and then said that there was somebody else that he wanted to introduce us to. Out from behind the curtain stepped his father. Needless to say, I was impressed with being in the presence of a governor and former president, along with elected senators from Texas, including other dignitaries. We were no more than 50 feet away from the platform. I would still be impressed today in the presence of such figures, but not nearly as much as in my younger days. Age does bring wisdom and puts things into much better perspective. Isaiah saw the seraphim above the temple. The word seraph means burning ones. The two wings covering their faces were probably doing so in order to protect them from being scorched by the blinding presence of God. The wings would act as a shield. Seeing the sun is a reminder of this blazing one. The sun's temperature is reportedly 27 million degrees Fahrenheit at its core, and 10,600 degrees Fahrenheit at its surface. To look directly into the sun with the naked eye would scorch the retina. This is part of the reason why God has said that no one can look at Him and live. We talk about a scorched earth policy. If He did not keep His distance from us, we would be disintegrated into ashes in a nanosecond. Often when God appeared, as recorded in the Old Testament, He did so in the form of fire. In Hebrews 12:28, we are to serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. Fire is one of the most destructive forces known to man. According to 2 Peter 3, God will destroy this present earth and heavens by fire, and He will create out of the ashes a new heavens and a new earth. New life will come from the old, just as we have after a forest is burned. Time replenishes what was burned. The fact that the seraph covered his feet probably speaks of self-humiliation. How else could lesser beings respond in the presence of the Great One? With two wings, the seraph also flew. This speaks of the mobility of the angels to move quickly to carry out the will of the Great One on His throne. And one cried to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory." Isaiah 6:3. The repetition of the word holy is for emphasis. The writer doesn't want it to be missed. Holiness is what God is by nature. He alone is holy. Holiness is what separates Him from His creation. Holiness is perfection in all of His attributes. In fact, the words holiness and wholeness come from the same root word. To become holy is to become whole. God is in the process of making us whole. 1 Peter 1:15 and 16 reminds us of this great truth. But as He who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, "Be holy, for I am holy." It is hard to define, but we know it when we see it, for we melt in its presence. The whole earth is full of His glory. The Hebrew word for glory is kabod, and is rich in various shades of meaning. It was used in reference to one's worth, his wealth, silver, and gold. It was also used of one's position, his eminence, power, and authority. A third meaning would be His divine and terrible radiance. In the words of an old Jewish epigram, God is not a kindly old uncle. He is an earthquake. That becomes clear in verse 4, where the posts of the door were shaken by the voice of Him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke. This ground was made holy by the presence of God. This opened the eyes of Isaiah to something else. Isaiah saw himself for what he was. Second, he saw himself. He became acutely aware of his own sinfulness and shortcomings, Isaiah 6:5 through 7. An encounter with the holiness of God brings us to the end of self-thinking and selfish prayer. It is no longer about us. We discover that we are not the center of the universe. He is. Not only was the temple shaking, but Isaiah was shaken to the very core of his being. His personal universe disintegrated. His feelings are verbalized in verse 5. "Woe is me, for I am undone, destroyed, cut off." We don't use the word woe anymore in conversation. It was frequently used in Scripture. The Hebrew word is oi. It was a pronouncement of doom. Isaiah saw himself as doomed. Peterson's The Message translates it, "Doom! It's doomsday! I'm as good as dead!" The word undone means to be coming apart, breaking up. It is similar to having an emotional breakdown. Today we would want to medicate him, or maybe even put him in a straitjacket and haul him away. Here was a man who once had it all together, but now sees it all coming apart. An evangelist friend, Sammy Tippett, shared that revival is not the top blowing off, but rather the bottom dropping out. For Isaiah, the bottom dropped out. He saw his own filthiness. He makes references to his own unclean lips. He was broken up over his own uncleanness and the uncleanness of the people around him. I remember as a child hearing about one of the great revivals that swept this country and produced this kind of response. One who longed for revival was heard leaning against a lamppost in New York City crying out, "Oh God, the sin of the city is breaking my heart." This was a moment for the reorienting of Isaiah's moral compass. He was no longer comparing his own morality with the people around him. Isaiah was all too familiar with the sin of Uzziah. Perhaps he was comparing himself with the great king, and he came out looking pretty good. There may have been some self-righteousness that needed to be eradicated from his life. We evangelicals had a tendency to do that with President Clinton. We found the nature of his moral failures involving many women to be revolting and disgusting. In contrast, we looked pretty good next to him, in our own eyes. But Isaiah now had the perfect standard of holiness before him, and he became vividly aware of his own sinfulness. Until we encounter God, we will never weep over our own sins or the sins of society around us. Why did Isaiah feel this way? He explains it in verse 5. "For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Years ago, our church choir had a party at a local country club. It was advertised, at least to Connie and me, as a 50s party. So we did as we were told and dressed up like we did back in the 50s. But there was a problem. Once we arrived there, we discovered that we were the only ones told that it was a 50s party. All others wore black tuxes, ties, and evening gowns. It was a great practical joke on us. How did we feel? We felt very out of place. We were very self-conscious. We felt that those who were not part of our group, but just coming and going from the club, must have been looking at us and thinking to themselves, "Why would those people ever come to a black tie function dressed like that?" This is how we feel when we are confronted by His awesome holiness. We are overwhelmed by our own sinfulness. We feel terribly out of place. Isaiah did not feel fit to be in His presence. But one of the seraphim took care of the problem as stated in verse 6. He flew over to Isaiah and touched his mouth with a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar. God burned his uncleanness away like using a gamma knife pointed toward the cancer within. We hear it expressed so many different ways, but the bottom line is that God must first work in us before he can work through us. Isaiah saw others. Third, Isaiah saw others, Isaiah 6:8. You cannot see God in that way and see yourself in this way without seeing others in a whole new way. This is why genuine revival among believers always results in a great tide of evangelism, bringing countless multitudes to Christ. A new burden for others brings with it a new boldness. If we could visualize the future nightmare of the countless numbers of people in eternal punishment, separated forever from the great giver of life, many of them our friends and next-door neighbors, we would have a whole new burden and boldness. God then speaks, saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" Isaiah has a whole new sensitivity to the call of God. Isaiah was quick to respond, "Here I am, send me." The New Living Translation renders it, "Lord, I'll go. Send me." God cannot use us until we come clean and are broken before Him. In the movie The Horse Whisperer, I recall the scene where the trainer, played by Robert Redford, breaks the horse down to its knees in order that it might learn submission. I had a local rancher once tell me that if the horse is too difficult to break, they will sometimes tie the legs of the horse together and take it down on the ground. Then they will throw a blanket over the head of the horse and leave it alone for a time. The horse must feel abandoned. But it is all for the purpose of breaking it in order that it might be made useful. Sometimes the procedure has to be repeated several times before the animal is broken. God must do the same with us. Are there times when you feel as though God has tied your arms and legs, allowed you to go down, and has just thrown a blanket over you and walked away from you? You might feel as though he's abandoned you and forgotten about you. But he could never turn his back on his own. It all has a divine purpose. Supposedly, A.W. Tozer has written that it is doubtful whether God can use a man greatly until he has hurt him deeply. In Isaiah 57:15, we read, "For thus says the high and lofty one who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble, to revive the heart of the contrite ones." The New Living Translation reads, "I refresh the humble and give new courage to those with repentant hearts." I have come back to this passage many times over. It has kept me in the race. I realize that there must be the constant renewing through confession. When that happens, I begin to more clearly see the needs of others around me. How about you? Where are you in the race? If you have a broken heart, you are in a good place. God is preparing you for something great. I thought I understood how holy God can be. The very thought of holiness, I thought, would set me free. I thought by seeing God as holier than I, my bleak horizons somehow would broaden like the sky. Until Isaiah 6 one day began to sink within, and I began to see my God in light of all my sin. The angels gathered round his throne of holiness did sing, louder, louder, holy, holy, did their chorus ring. And as their music touched my heart, no matter how I tried, I could barely say the words, "I am unclean," I cried. Deeper, no, the spirit went until with heated coal he burned the concept holiness into my very soul. "Now you see yourself, my child," my Jesus said to me. "You are a filthy sinner. Now you can be free." With that, he placed upon my lips that burning fiery coal and said, "Now go in peace. My grace has made thee whole. Now I can send you, child of mine, into the battle's din, for you have seen a holy God, and you have seen your sin."